Okay, I think we're going to get started. Welcome, everyone. I know there are still a few people streaming in through the doors, but maybe we can close the doors and get going. A reminder to all to please turn off your phones so that we don't get interrupted. So thanks all for being here. Welcome, everyone. We are going to get started. I'm Luna Federici, the Vice President of Funding Strategy at Lending Club, and I will be your MC for this session today. I'm thrilled to be here and thrilled to be with all of you. Lending Club is proud to support the Conference for Women because we have a shared commitment to motivating, inspiring, and celebrating our diverse employee base. We do this in a number of ways through unconscious bias training, employee-run resource groups, and a commitment to equal pay for equal roles. This conference is a fantastic combination of practical tools and advice, inspiration, and peer networking. Through the many series that we're offering today, we hope to inspire you to make your mark on your companies, your careers, and your communities. Thank you for participating in this session today on how to retire with enough money. We have an amazing hour in store for you. And with that, I'd like to introduce you to our speaker today, Teresa Ghilarducci. Teresa is an expert on retirement, pensions, and personal savings. She has authored a number of award-winning books on these subjects and has been featured in Business Week, The New York Times, and more. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Teresa Ghilarducci. Hi.
Thank you. Very good. There's a couple of things you need to know about me. Because we're talking about planning for your own retirement, I am a professor, a tenure professor. All my income comes from students. Many of them may come from the parents of students, but I don't work for or get money from any financial firm. And that's really important for you to know when anyone is giving you advice about money. Because unfortunately, in America, planning for your retirement is one big marketing campaign. We have a very unusual system in the United States. It's a do-it-yourself, sort of a DIY system of retirement. It's an experiment that has been conducted on the baby boomer generation. It is one of a kind. Other countries don't do it like this. And what it is that when you first start out in working, you're supposed to figure out, first, how long you will work, how much you will earn, who you will marry, when who you will marry will leave, when who you will marry will die, when you will die, and whether or not your children are going to, you know, head for bail court or college. These are all the things you need to know. And if that wasn't all, you need to know what the Bundesbank is going to do in reaction to the Greek financial crisis and what exchange rates might be once the Eurozone deals with Brexit. It is an enormously complex world to be able to know how much consumption to defer now in order to have enough later. And if you have to do it on your own by investing in international and global markets, then you are solving a problem that Nobel Prize winner Robert Merton said is one of the most complex problems to solve analytically. It is a non-linear optimization model, and I know I can talk like that here in Silicon Valley. It is really difficult with all the unknown variables and all the other complications. But here we are. Here we are in this world. We have Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, which I will talk about as one of the most important foundations of your retirement security. Medicaid, or Medi-Cal in California, is it's called. Most of the money will be going towards middle-class adults when they go into nursing homes. It's mainly become an old-age income security program. So I will end the program with talking about the present value of your Social Security promise, Medicare, and Medicaid, but I want to start with you right now. Because our retirement system is based on one big marketing campaign about what vehicle, what private commercial vehicle to have in your 401k, how to choose among those commercial vehicles in your 401k, how to choose a for-profit advisor who's a conflicted, is not a fiduciary, how to choose the individual retirement account sponsor and the vehicles within that individual retirement account sponsor. Because it's one big marketing campaign, it's sort of like shopping for a car. That you really can't believe the advice that you're getting. It's all conflicted. And it also makes you be put in a situation where you know less than the people who are trying to sell things to you, and that puts you in a weaker power power position in a hierarchy. So all my book talks about, and all I will talk about, is how to find the roles you have in this environment in order to gain more power. So I'm going to reframe this whole idea about financial literacy and reframe the whole idea about advice. So the first thing you need to know is the five roles that you need to activate and empower and know about in order to navigate yourself through a comfortable retirement. I'm not going to teach you how to be rich in retirement. I had to fight with my publisher on the title. My publisher wanted to title it, How to Retire with Plenty of Money. And I'm really pretty accommodating and nice. I said, absolutely not. I am not going to write that kind of a book, guys. I know you sell cookbooks, and my publisher wrote the book we all read, What to Expect When You're Expecting. All right, that one. They love that. They knew the titles. I said, no, this is the wrong title. I want everyone to have enough. I'm not going to promise plenty, you know, or to be rich, because that's not the game that we're in here. It's about having a steady amount of money for the rest of your life. So if you were a middle-class worker, you stay a middle-class retiree, that you actually can give gifts to your grandchildren all the way into the rest of your death, that you don't worry about whether or not you're going to have enough money because you can live until 95. You're not going to be one of those people who die with $25,000 in a shoebox put away because you've skipped lunch for 10 years because you didn't know if you would have enough. This is actually what's happening in America today. The uncertainty of not having a steady stream of income for the rest of your life because Social Security isn't enough, and we've taken pensions and turned them into 401ks, is actually causing quite a bit of misery, and you're not going to be in that situation. So you need to know that to navigate your way through the American way of planning for retirement, you are going to have to view yourself as a saver, and I'll give you tips about what savers do. The flip side of saving is a consumer, and I'm going to walk you through brain chemistry to talk about the recent research on what consumption does. Third, you have to navigate your way to retirement by navigating your way through work and strategies when you're over 50. And women, when you're over 50, there are a number of strategies you need to know. Age discrimination for women is worse than for men, but it's quite present for men. Fourth, you're going to have to understand your role as a investor. You're going to have to know that in our do-it-yourself system, you're going to have to know the difference between a stock and a bond and the predators and the non-predators. All right, that's probably more important than whether or not you know what an ETF and a growth-weighted value stock is. You have to be able to meet out the predators. I was at the World Congress of Gerontology and Gerontologists last year. I thought it was going to be a dull conference. It was fascinating. Half the people were doctors talking about life extension. Some of us were about, you know, public policy. And there were a huge section and growing on financial abuse for older people. So it's quite a dark side of this do-it-yourself system. And the last role that you need to know is your role as a voter and the kinds of government programs that you need to preserve. So getting yourself to a healthy retirement is a partnership between your financial institution, between you and your family and your employer, and through the government. All four people are important actors, or institutions are actors in your foundation. So it is saver, consumer, worker, investor, voter. Five roles which will give you power to have enough retirement security. So first, the saver. If you are in your 20s and you're just starting work, even if it's uncertain work, very low income work, you need to save 5% of your take-home pay, even if it's bookus, even if it's really small, you have to save 5% of very small, right? It is almost like paying your taxes. You have to pay Social Security taxes, just add on to your Social Security tax. That's the good news. If you are in your 20s and you save consistently for 42 years, 5% of your current consumption is the only amount you need to sacrifice in order to have a adequate or enough in retirement with your Social Security. That's actually the good news. We haven't given our youth a lot of gifts, but we've given them the gift of youth. Time matters a lot in the do-it-yourself system. Many of you aren't in your 20s. Some of you are. You're the lucky ones. You only have to sacrifice a bit. Now let me take you to your 30s. If you're in your 30s, it's not too late, but this is the time that you should have a year's salary in the bank for any emergency. So when the freezer or the car breaks or something else happens, you have to go to funerals, you have to pay $600 for a plane ticket, you have that in the bank. By 30, you should have no debt. I'll talk about mortgage debt in a minute, but you just have stopped borrowing money to buy cars. That just is not something that you do anymore. You certainly don't borrow money for groceries, for clothes, for what we economists call non-consumer durables. Even consumer durables should be part of your advance payment plan. Houses and mortgages, I'll talk about in a minute. So when you're 30 and you have no debt and you have emergency savings already signed up, you should be saving 7 to 10%. Okay, and you can count your employer's contribution in that amount. So if you're in a 401k and your employer provides 3%, you add the other 7. Right? Then you'll be good to go. Right? If you are in your 40s, things are a little worse. You have nothing. You followed my advice somehow, and you don't have debt except mortgage debt. But you haven't saved anything in a 401k and an IRA, you need to actually up it not from 3 to 10, but it starts becoming nonlinear. You need to save 15 to 20. You do that, though, you work until 65, you're good to go, right? So you have to get the amounts right. If you're 50, I have a more difficult and uncomfortable time talking to you. I really do. I still talk to you. But it is really difficult. You will need to save 25 to 30% of what you earn. And there's something even more difficult when you're talking to a 40 or 50-year-old parent, and that's because their children's financial needs are also intertwined or enmeshed. So I'll talk about that advice in a minute. I just want to get the math. So you get the idea. If you start early, it's really a trivial sacrifice of current consumption. If you start in your 30s, it's manageable. If you start later, you really have to earn a lot. If you're in your 50s and you have nothing, you have another strategy. Save as much as you can, delay retirement, and use whatever cash you have to delay collecting Social Security. So one thing you can do with an inadequate amount of money, it won't take you all the way to, you know, 95, is that you can use it up fast and delay collecting Social Security. I suspect there'll be a lot of questions about that claiming age, and we can get to that later. But right now, I just want you to view yourself as a saver, and what a saver does is save. And I just gave you some benchmarks about how much to save, and it depends upon timing. Okay, now you are a consumer. Because the flip side of saving is that you look at your budget. You all have a budget, right? You all write down what you spend, and you all consolidate by the end of the month, right? You wouldn't be thinking about the future unless you actually were mindful and knowledgeable about your present. Right? It's kind of painful and it's really awkward to do the first couple of months, but then it becomes a matter of habit, like brushing your teeth. It's really money hygiene. In fact, it's very hard to have a conversation about planning for retirement unless you know your baseline. But here's the pain of it. You write down your budget and you have to find 5%. Well, you can't take 5% off your fixed bills, right? That's already fixed. So then you have to take 5% off the stuff that's not your fixed bills. And that's all the fun stuff. It's all the fun stuff. So it's not 5% off of going out to eat. It's 15% of going out to eat. And I know it's painful. That's why when you choose your biggest expense, which is where you live, and also it's going to be college education, that is chosen well. That is chosen well. You go below what everybody else is doing. Because as a consumer, Thorsten Veblen, John Kenneth Galbraith, Juliette Shore, Robert Frank, all the Nobel Prize winners in behavioral economics know one thing, that we're social animals and we consume what we call conspicuous consumption because we are charmingly human. We want to fit in and we also want to jostle our way up a social hierarchy. And the way you jostle yourself up a social hierarchy is a lot like peacocks do. You have bigger feathers and you display. You display the purse. Sorry, men, but I'm talking to women and they know what I'm talking about. You display the highlights in the hair is actually a visual about how much money I have. A more sophisticated view, I live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, if you've read that book. People can tell like how much work you've had. There's lots of ways that little tribes can actually display where you're on the hierarchy. In Manhattan, you can't do it with your car because no one sees your car, but you can do it with all these other things. But everybody has a tell, and everybody wants to display the tell to be in a social hierarchy. That will mean that you overconsume that which is visible and underconsume that which is not, which is your savings or your security. So your brother-in-law might have a BMW, but you actually have $250,000 in your IRA, but the brother-in-law gets all the looks, right? So you have to know, and these are the words, that we are built in a consumer society for conspicuous consumption, and that we all are in an arms race. That we all are trying to actually ratchet up our hierarchy with bigger houses, and had the family size has shrunk as the average size of homes has actually gone up by 3 times. So we overconsume that which is visible. So my advice, knowing about confirmation bias and endowment, the endowment effect in behavioral economics, is that what you have is actually worth a little bit more. You hang on to it because you have it, even though you would never go buy it. And that which you seek will create a dopamine reaction, so that the dopamine of seeking, of going shopping, the dopamine, you know it when you've actually fallen in love with someone and you only want to be with that person or think about that person. That's a dopamine reaction. It's the wanting, the desire brain chemical that is ever present, and it feels really good. The other thing that feels good is an opioid response, a kind of pleasure and warmth, the relaxation. You deserve it. They're selling a lot of spa services with the hope of the opiate response. And the other brain chemistry is serotonin. And serotonin doesn't have that urge, that desire effect, doesn't have that opioid or the kind of pleasure and feel no pain kind of effect. It's the satisfaction that one gets with doing something hard, but having a feeling of mastery. It comes over time. But once you have the serotonin, with doing your work, working on your manuscript. I'm a writer, so that's what I know about, even though I hate writing, but I hate not writing more. Filling out a math problem, maybe doing something really complicated that it's hard to do, but not doing it is harder. That's the serotonin response. It gives you a feeling of satisfaction and empowerment. That you don't get out of buying and consuming. The serotonin rarely comes from the stuff that you have. It's the dopamine and the opioid, the dopamine and the opioid, that real strong feeling you have after you've acquired something. But what is really odd that neuroscientists are showing is that what you want is often what you don't like. Because after a week or two, you asked, how much pleasure does that pair of shoes give you? You almost are back to baseline. That what you felt about it when you were seeking it, once you got it, you're actually back to baseline. You all know that's true. You've all lived that, but it is called the wanting-liking cycle. It has sociobiological roots. It helps with the reproduction of the species, but it doesn't help with retirement planning. So, fall in love with your stuff when you want to go shopping. Go, whoa. Stuff, I once loved you. Let me look at you again. I'm not kidding. Instead of going out to the mall, go to the closet. Take it all out. Take it all out. Put it on the hangers like they do in the stores. Color coordinate them. Put them in racks. And then choose lovingly. You can wrap them up in tissue paper. You can go out and have a cappuccino. Come back and put it in your closet. You'll save a lot more money. And then the serotonin will come later. This is science. Scientists shows this. I have my students, there's actually experiments with rats. And they tell me about how they're manipulated every day with wanting something. The little rats have to press a lever to get a little bit of cocaine. And then how the rats actually are never satisfied. And they call it the rat thing when we talk about shopping. So I hope, without going through, you know, an undergraduate class where I teach, that you'll think of when you're going to the mall and you're going through those aisles and everybody has laid the stuff out to you, that you think of yourself, I'm just like a rat. I am just like a rat. So the saving part should actually be easier once you know about what's driving the consumer part. It's not your fault. It's not American consumerism. We've had laws for sumptuary and luxury laws since the Florentines had their sumptuary laws. It's really something that happens in human societies. We're geared towards the short term, not the long run, and it's really hard to plan for retirement because you have to actually have empathy for your old self. Okay, now we're in the work area. The work area is difficult in our changing workplace because a lot of technology is helpful to us. Most technology makes us more valuable to our employer, but some of the technology is actually making our skills obsolete faster. That the throughput speed of some of our occupations are faster than how long we have to work. So there is, not in all occupations, but there is a necessity for older workers to keep up. And the way you can do it is don't borrow money to get a worthless master's degree at a school like where I teach. Don't do that. There is hardly any master's degree worth $60,000 over when you're in your 40s. It just isn't worth it. But what you can do is badge yourself. Remember when you were in Scouts? And you had a whole list of accomplishments, like, I can build a fire underwater. Pretty awesome. Not that useful, but you get the idea. Everybody knows what you had to do to be able to build a fire underwater. There's a list, there's a little book, an adult checked you out. You can do this with Coursera, you know, or the Khan Academy. And they're very sophisticated programs. 1% of people complete those courses online. So if you actually can complete those courses online and prove it, you're one in 1,000. You already can tell your employer that you can get this skill. So over 40, 45, badge yourself with the skills that you know in your profession. Make sure that you can show those. After 50, everybody knows that you're older, but don't tell them. Don't make jokes about senior moments ever. Ever. It's not funny anymore. Imagine if you were African-American and you made jokes that we saw in the hideous kinds of plays and theater back in the 20s. The kind of the body language that was deferring and self-deprecating. You see older women do that all the time, and older men too. Oh, I'm having a senior moment. Oh, I used to remember things. I can't anymore. Stop doing that. Stop doing that. You're actually adding to your own victimization. It can be a strategy in some environments, in environments where the discrimination is allowed. Let's not let it be allowed. Let's not let it be allowed, and don't be a party of it. So I hope that one thing that you take away from that is that you never talk about that anymore. And it's going to be a really hard habit to break for people here over 50. Just don't do it. And you know it's very important at the workplace that you are always willing to learn more skills or to make up to the challenge. Your employer cares about your age, but they really care about making money. That's really what you want. So you always want to signal that. A lot of strategies that deal with age discrimination. It's a very hard violation of the law to prove. It's real. You have to be very, very mindful in order to confront it. The second to the last rule, quickly, is about investments. These are easies. This is easy. First, there will be a recession. I don't know when. But there will be a recession. This is the longest expansion we ever had. Congress cut taxes and exploded the budget, the deficit, in a way that sort of no Congress has and president has ever done before. But that has a stimulus effect on the economy. And that kind of a stimulus usually isn't that big when we're already in an expansion. It's much better to have deficits and cut taxes when you're in a recession, but it will have a stimulus. It might take them through the November election. People now are getting $1,000 temporary tax cut, so that will have an effect. But interest rates are increasing, and there's an increasing concern worldwide about the instability of U.S.-issued debt. And there is, but you all live in the Bay Area, some signs of I know, Luna, you're very, you know about mortgage-backed securities, but there is a bubbly aspect to some of the housing markets. And if you're leveraged on that, then there won't be as bad as last time. There's no sign of that, like in 2008, but there will be a recession. That means that your stock values are going to fall, your bond values will go up, and the only strategy in up and down markets, and they're all up and down, is diversification, right? I am a professional investor. I am a trustee of $56 billion and another couple of billion dollars in two big trust funds. And I manage my own money as I do that, which is I stay the course. I have a discipline, and it's very, very strict about how much risk I want to take. I really pay no attention to daily movements. I rebalance once a year. I do it in February. All right. I also take advice from people that do not make money based on my decision. That's called a non-conflicted advisor. You find them rarely. In urban areas, you can find them, but they're called fee-only advisor. And if you ask them, are you a fiduciary, they say yes. They don't say a bunch of other words to avoid saying yes or no. They say yes, and those are the only ones that you should have it. I have a page in my book that says how to fire your guy. Because if your guy, sometimes she's a woman, but if your guy, like in, oh, I have this guy who does all my investments, you need to fire that if they don't answer these 10 questions. The first one is, are you a fiduciary? All right, so it's actually something in my book you can rip out and put in your wallet. Somebody said I should write that in the book, and I did it. It really does work. You also can do it yourself if you go to Vanguard. I have no ties to Vanguard, but Vanguard is unusual because it's a mutual-owned company. All the profits go to their owners, like every other for-profit company, but the owners in Vanguard are the account owners. It's a mutual company. The only way that they can discharge their profits is to lower the fees or improve the technology. There are no shareholders or board of shareholders that they have to, like Fidelity or all the other, or T. Rowe Price or Merrill Lynch or Bank of America or everybody else. They don't please another group. It's only the account holders. And there they put you in what's called an index fund, which is that they just buy the whole market. And then your only decision then, after you've decided not to overpay in fees, is how much risk to take. And there's some advice in the book or everywhere about how much risk to take. It basically is, as you get older, you take less. Right? It's once you get out from under the predators and the conflicted advisors, the investment part turns out to be the easiest part of this whole thing. I think the savings part is a lot more complicated. The dopamine, the opiate, the serotonin, the rats, that's more complicated. You just get rid of the predators on the investment, you're good to go. The last thing, and I'm ending here, is that you need 8 times what you want to live on for the rest of your life at 65, meaning if you want to live on $50,000 for the rest of your life, you actually need $400,000 in your 401k or IRA to add to your Social Security, and you're good to go. But that's about it, $40,000. That's a little bit conservative, because when I really say it's 10 to 15, nobody has it, and I feel kind of stupid, all right? So I actually lowball it. Myself aim for having 10 times or 15 times what I want to spend, and that's a lot, I think, because I know I want to travel and do all that above. So multiply by 10 what you want to live on, and it's a really big number, but if you're young, you can get to it. Why do you only need that? Because underlying that, you have a Social Security stream of income. And if you do the present value calculation, for most people, it's worth about $250,000, right? So that actually helps you get to $1 million worth if $1 million is what a middle-class person needs, add in the $250,000 in Social Security, you're now down to only having to do $750,000. Medicare, if you're real sick, is worth a lot. If you're healthy a lot, it's not worth very much. So you have to actually impute the insurance value. That's about $200,000-$300,000. Medicaid, for all of you who are going to be in cognitive decline, that's a lot. It's going to be 40% of you who make it to age 85. Medicaid is your friend and also your family's friend, because the whole your whole wealth won't have to be, and your family's wealth won't have to be depleted, because you'll be able to take care of by a Medicaid. So it's important. I don't care if they're left-wing, right-wing, Democrat, Republican, upwing, downwing, whatever kind of political affiliation, you need your political candidates to understand that those programs are just basic to the economic security of the nation, and they have to preserve that. No experimenting with those programs. They're the most popular programs for good reason in the country. So now I'll stop talking and take your questions.
Thank you. I loved the biology lesson about consumerism, mm-hmm. and I'm certainly tempted to go home and unpack my entire closet and find what I really love.
Put it back in.
Yes. So before I turn it over to the audience for questions, I wanted to just start with one of my own. So let's say today was the first day that I really started to think about retirement for my future self. Yeah. What would be the one thing that I should start doing or stop doing immediately?
Yeah, you have to start paying attention to where you spend money. All right, so today you're going to actually think about where all those purchases, all that information goes. You don't really need sort of a Quicken program or something really complicated. Maybe just use one credit card and then download everything on the credit card and sort it. Work with your partner, your financial partners, probably your husband or wife or whoever, and figure out the categories. And it takes about 1 or 2 months, but do it monthly. But pay attention to those categories.
Great advice. Yeah. We should all do. So now I'll open it up to the audience for questions. We've got two microphones in these aisles. It would be great if you were able to make your way to the aisle. Or you can just speak loudly.
Yeah, or just yell.
Sure.
I'll ask a question. So I'm in my early 40s,
yeah.
And one of the things my husband and I are planning is, now that we are a little older, we have more savings, a little more no debt, let's say, it's how do you balance making investments with a little bit of risk about trying to climb maybe that social ladder you talk about or economic ladder with protecting your retirement?
Well, you really need to know your number about how much you need in your retirement first. So this is going to sound mean, and I don't mean to be, but you might not have as much money as you think you do. So if you're in your 40s and you want $1 million when you're at 65, you should be close to having $400,000 each to be on track for retirement. Okay, good. You're good. If you're there, that's good.
I think it's balancing the investment side, right? I think the retirement seems, because we've, you know,
401k on track,
since I was 20, right? So I've been building that up, and I think I'm kind of there. Yeah. But it's sort of, how do I protect that? As at the same time trying to make investments that are either going to secure me further or get me ahead.
Okay, I get that you're in a really nice position, but stay there by always saving the maximum into your tax-protected or tax-qualified accounts. Only 5% save the maximum available. And now, this is February. It's a really good time to have this conversation. At Watermark, I always like it when it's in February, not later in September, because you should all now go to your HR director and say, max me out. Only 5% of people do max out, and if you start doing it in February, it's not a big hit to your paycheck as it would be if you did it in November. So do you max out?
I do.
Okay.
And I actually wanted to.
And your husband
advice.
Does?
Now he does. When he started, he didn't. I think one of the advice I got at a women's conference when I was really young was that because I might leave the workforce, even though I haven't, that I always wanted to max out or do more because I never knew if I was going to be in the workforce all the time.
Actually, if you for women who leave the workforce and go out, it's really hard to catch up again. So if you do leave the workforce, don't leave the savings. You make sure you have an IRA, but the IRAs are limited. So that's a whole other strategy. So max out. Okay, so your investments, well, then that's easy. Just, you know, go make sure you have sound investments. Buy low and sell high. That's all. The important thing is that usually a bigger house is not a good investment. And usually a 30-year mortgage, there's a lot in the book about this, is not a good investment because of the interest, all the interest you have to pay. If you can't buy a home and pay it off in 15 years with a 10 to 20% down payment, you're buying too much home. So insist to the broker, who's also trying to sell you more house than you need, that you're going to pay it for 15 years and you're going to put 10% down, and just make them help you with those constraints. Sure. You should take it, Luna.
Actually, let's go over to this side.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I wasn't paying attention. Yeah, hi.
All right, one of the, obviously, the things I keep hearing is about the recession is coming, and I have a lot of investments in Vanguard right now.
Yeah.
Medium risk, but, I mean, does that mean I should pull it out?
No, so Vanguard is just your holder, and your investments are either bonds or stocks in Vanguard. And if you have an advisor in Vanguard, the Vanguard person told you your median risk, and that's your portfolio discipline, stay the course. And when the stocks go down and your bonds go up, you're going to stay the course by buying a few more stocks and less bonds. So they'll help you guide to keep your investor discipline. So you don't, you're not investing in Vanguard, they're just managing it.
Right.
Yeah. No, you're in good shape. It's going to go down. You just have to make sure you know that you're not realizing it, that if you keep your discipline, then over time it should get about 5 to 6%.
So return. I should maybe weigh it more in the...
Stay the course.
In the bonds more than stocks, right?
You have a discipline, and they'll help you adjust when the prices adjust.
Okay.
The recession should not change your discipline. Mm-hmm. The discipline is taking into account that there'll be ups and downs. That's what I mean.
All right.
The only thing that should change your discipline is your age.
Mm. And one more question for, let's say, an easy platform for somebody like me that I'm not an investor.
You know,
I use E-Trade. It seems a bit
confusing.
It's
predatory. Mm-hmm. It's not confusing. It's actually predatory.
Yeah.
It will get you. People who do invest in E-Trade lose money.
Okay.
So don't do that.
All right.
Just stay with Vanguard.
Okay.
Stay with Vanguard, and they charge you like a tenth of what E-Trade will charge, and you won't make the kinds of mistakes.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Great. Let's move back over to this side here.
Hi. Yeah, in the 401k plans, they offer, like, I guess it's a blended fund, like you choose what year you plan to retire, and then you get into, like, Fidelity 2025.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that those are a good strategy?
Who's your manager? Is it Fidelity or Vanguard?
I thought it was Fidelity.
I think it is Fidelity. I think the important decision to make is to go to Vanguard. And actually billions of dollars are flowing out of Fidelity's, out of places, into Vanguard. And Fidelity should be able to get that money back if they have the same kind of practices as Vanguard, but until they do. And what you do is you go to Vanguard and you tell them where your money is, and they contact Fidelity for you. And Fidelity is used to it, right? There's tons of money flowing from all these other places. But you asked a very specific question that you may have been put into what's called a age-weighted fund or a time fund, and it takes your age into account, and then it balances it. Like, if you're really young, it puts you in stock, and as you get older, it puts you into bonds. Very similar to the question, to the answer I gave last time. But usually they charge you too much to do that. You can do it more cheaply with Vanguard.
It seems like it's so conservative, you know.
No, it's probably right.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's going anywhere.
Yeah, good. Good, actually. That's the whole idea about plenty and enough. Okay. You know, it's not going anywhere because the markets are pretty perfect. If it's going someplace, you're taking on a lot of risk. And so you have to risk adjust your rates of return. And a expected risk adjusted rate of return for the long term is around 5 to 7. So that's you don't want it to go negative 24, because that's somewhere too.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks.
So no. I would not be worried about that. I'd be worried about your fees.
Okay.
Great. Back to the other
side. Two quick questions. What's your position about annuities? The one I chose is no lose, but up to 6% a year.
Yeah, I think they're no.
No.
In my book, I did assess that. The book is really small, but it didn't take that long to have that conclusion. And you all get it. You remember the individual health insurance market, where if you didn't have an employer, you had to go out and buy your own health insurance. And the health insurance company says, okay, I can insure you for your sickness, but since you went out to seek out to buy the insurance, I know that you probably are sicker than usual, so I'm going to have to charge a higher fee. The same thing with the annuity market. If you go to an insurance company and say, hey, I want to give you $100,000, but you pay me for the rest of your life, the insurance company knows that you're probably biased towards being a long liver, and they have to actually charge you to take account of what's called that adverse selection or moral hazard. So a private, voluntary insurance market always has the same problem. The people who want it are going to be overcharged. So the best thing to do is to keep your money in a Vanguard account. Did I say that? Yeah, I did. A Vanguard account. And then take the money out according to what the IRS actually says. Yeah, when you're younger, you take out like 3%. And then as you get older, you can ratchet up to like 4 or 5%. And that's about the same thing that an annuity does.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, if I can get you all away from annuities and whole life insurance, I'll be happy. Today. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm just taking a turn.
Sorry. This is just a quick one. Do you have guidance on how to estimate what is enough to live on?
Yeah. Yeah. You take, so one way to do it is, like, take how much money you think you want to live on when you're older, and just ignore inflation. Just take out the money that you can live on now. Multiply it by 10.
Oh, that's the multiplier. Okay. And then, is it per year?
Oh, that would be the lump, and then you take, yeah, and then that lump will actually then give you enough money for the 20 years that you'll be alive.
And my other question is around kids and how to kind
of... Yes, kids, yes.
...account for all the unpredictability.
Yes, my favorite topic. Do not take money out of your 401k to pay for an overpriced college, right? If you want to, like, live on ramen noodles to get your kid to the dream school, you know, whose price is too high, then that's fine. That's on you, but on your current self. But don't borrow money from your future self to pay for your kid's overpriced college. Is that the part of kid you were talking about?
Yeah, a little bit of that.
About?
And also, I've been given conflicting guidance on the 529.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do. You'll need that money to apply to pay for the application fees. Right. Yeah. No, those are fine. But make sure that you actually are in a low fee investment option. Yeah. How about the woman in the red coat? If you have a real quick one. Oh, I love the long-term care. I hired somebody in my research group because he wrote a paper, long-term care insurance, worse than useless. There are no big insurance companies now that are selling long-term care insurance. That's because the big ones know that it's a risk that they don't want to take. So the insurance companies that are selling long-term care insurance now are the smaller ones and less solvent. And one thing that you have to know is that when you're 90, that insurance company will still be around. If they're not, there's no payment. Long-term care insurance depends upon payments of your premiums every month. And 40% of the people lapse, mainly because they forget to pay or their income falls so much when they're older that they can't pay. And that's a discretionary outcome. So they paid all that money and they don't get any of the benefit if they would need it, and the insurance companies know that. That's based in their business model of these high lapse rates. No, we are in big trouble in this country because we don't have long-term care insurance, and my suggestion here as voters is to actually add long-term care to Medicare. It would be less than 1% of tax on our Medicare, and let's just cover long-term care as a medical expense. So don't buy long-term care insurance. Okay.
Yeah. So our company for the retirement plan sponsors like one is 401k, one is Roth, I guess.
Great.
After tax.
Oh.
So which one should I choose? I heard some people say that certain age I should start to choose, not the 401k.
So the Roth versus the IRA. The Roth accounts now are used mainly as a trust planning tool for the rich. Most people use the Roth in order to put money in so that their heirs can inherit a big chunk of money, and that really is relevant for the top 2%. For most of us, a IRA, a traditional IRA is best, but every situation is different. You should talk to your tax accountant. It is not a crucial decision to make. The most crucial decision for you to make is to save as much as possible in your 401k. Are you a maxer? Do you maximize?
Yeah,
okay, so now you want to maximize the Roth and the IRA. Your tax accountant can tell you the best ones, but it really won't matter that much.
Yeah, but I heard someone say that if your 401k to certain numbers, suppose you better to switch to the Roth or something?
No, stay in the 401k. The 401k is a much better vehicle because your employer contributes to it, and you also have fiduciary protection with a 401k. If they overcharge you, there's actually regulatory recourse. In an IRA, they're not so regulated. So the 401k is better for those two reasons.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
So we have time for one more question.
Okay. And I have a workshop today at 3 o'clock, and I'll answer. It's all Q&A. In the workshop.
So living in the Bay Area, housing's really expensive.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, a lot of our money is going into buying our house. Sometimes we double our money too, living in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
But how does the housing, like your housing investment and your equity in your home weigh into this?
Yeah, it counts. Okay, that's a great question. So you probably are spending about 41% of your, just looking at you, I know the numbers, on your housing expenses, right?
Well, I actually bought a multi-home, so I'm getting someone else to help pay for my mortgage.
Yeah, exactly, right. And that, but so your annual budget, you know, should not be more than 35 to 40% on housing. You are building up equity in your home. The equity will go up and down. In the Bay Area, sometimes it's gone way up, like twice as much as average, and sometimes it's actually fallen the most. So I would, and for your retirement planning, it's a very small part of your financial. It's not liquid, it's not fungible, it's very risky. You certainly don't want to buy housing to help with your investment. Oh, you asked me about the other investments outside of 401k.
Like how that weighs into
don't
all the numbers.
Don't buy an investment property in the same area you have your residential. It's like putting way too much money in local real estate. It's not diversified enough.
Okay.
All right, so don't, and then when you retire, make sure you have your mortgage paid off. That's one of the biggest concerns of retirement experts is that people are going into retirement with mortgage debt.
But how does that weigh into your calculations of like the 10% of what you want to live
on? It doesn't.
Okay.
It doesn't. Yeah, that's just a lifestyle expense. And if you have your house, it's just going to lower the amount of money you need to live on.
Okay.
So it really is just an expense. It's not an investment. It's your consumption.
Okay.
Yeah, that I see your question now.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. But don't overinvest by buying your house here and then buy a rental property in the same area.
We've got one very eager question in the front row here.
I just want to carry on from her. If you are at retirement age and you have not paid your house off, your recommendation be to sell it?
It depends on how much. That's a little bit. But if you need to downsize, do it sooner rather than later. Yes.
All right. Yeah. Well, our session is over today. Teresa will be available for more questions this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll be there.